You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
All right. Good morning, everybody. All right, so Dr. Welcher can testify that the data he downloaded and analyzed and the damage to the Lexus is consistent with Ms. Reed's vehicle being in a collision on January 29th at 12:32 a.m. because he's a qualified expert and his opinion is based on reliable methodology appropriately applied. In addition, Dr. Welcher can testify that Mr. O'Keefe's injuries are consistent with his having been struck by a Lexus that is physically identical to Ms. Reed's Lexus, because this opinion is based upon, among other things, his experimental work that came into evidence without objection as to scientific methodology and application. However, he may not testify that Ms. Reed's Lexus collided with Mr. O'Keefe because that conclusion is not based on the application of reliable scientific methodology. The problem here is not that the opinion concerns the ultimate issue, because in Massachusetts, that's not a bar to admissibility. Rather, it is that Dr. Welcher, the expert, is drawing an inference based upon more than scientific method. His opinions set the stage for argument and a permissible inference to be drawn by jurors through the application of their sound judgment to the opinions that they find credible. But the jurors are as well positioned to draw or reject the inference as is the expert. That is, the inference is not compelled by the application of any scientific method. So that's the ruling. All right, so the jurors are lining up. We should have them momentarily.
Thank you for the late call today.
Okay. Is Dr. Welcher right around?
Yes.
Why don't we bring him in if he's here before the jurors?
The updated version, we provided a copy to the defense with all the redactions.
Okay. Are you in agreement with this, Mr. Alessi?
I haven't gone through, but I have no reason to believe that I wouldn't be in agreement. So
okay.
There is one slide, so I'll admit it conditional to redactions that you didn't rule on, but I feel as though you probably will exclude, and that is in that version. I didn't want to pull it out with the court's order, but I'll talk to
Do you know the number? You don't have to find it if you don't.
It's 131.
Oh, is this the, was it 130, was it 131 yesterday too?
It was.
So at sidebar, I said we could go back to that. Mr. Lessie agreed that we could go back to that. So, and I know I thought we were starting there, and I think Dr. Welcher thought we were starting there, and then you went to 132. That was my understanding at sidebar.
It is, but subject to me being able to object. I was basically because we wanted the jury to come in, so I want to look at the slide.
Okay, so look at it again. That's not my understanding, Mr. Alessi. It was you were concerned just about the heading, okay. And then I said we'd go back to both slides.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm okay with that. Yeah. That one, yes, Your Honor's recollection is correct.
Yeah, and we were going to start on that, but you thought because I struck it based on the objection, but then at sidebar I said we could go back to that. That's your understanding,
that's
too.
Correct, Your Honor. Yeah, I'm sure that Dr. Walsh took off the heading on 131.
I think he did, but because I think he took off from 124 to 1.
I think he did as well.
He did. I did.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
I would like your prediction to come true.
Are they out there, Paul? Okay, thank you.
We try to the jury.
Thank you.
Hear ye. All persons have any business before the Honorable Beverly Cannoni, Justice of the Norfolk Superior Court, and for the County of Norfolk. Draw near, give your attendance, and you shall be heard. God save the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. This court is now open. You may be seated.
All right, good morning again, counsel. Good morning again, Ms. Reed. Morning, Dr. Welch.
Good morning, Your Honor.
And good morning, jurors. Good morning. I have to ask you those same three questions. Was everyone able to follow my instructions and refrain from discussing this case with anyone since we left yesterday?
Yes.
Everyone said yes or nodded affirmatively. Were you also able to follow the instruction and refrain from doing any independent research or investigation into this case?
Yes.
Everyone said yes or nodded affirmatively. Did anyone happen to see, hear, or read anything about this case since we left yesterday? Everyone said no or shook their heads. Thank you very much. All right, Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Your Honor. Morning, Dr. Welcher.
Good morning.
When we left off yesterday, I was asking you about some of your opinions. I'm going to ask you those questions again, but before we do, I'm going to ask you two other questions. The first is, I'd ask you to turn to your PowerPoint, slide 110.
You want me to display it?
Please. I'm going to ask you a question about a series of your slides regarding this effort. This is 110. Could you also follow through to 111, 12, 13, 14, 15?
You want me to play the videos?
You don't need to play the videos. I just want to acquaint you for the question.
111.
12.
112. 113. 114, 115.
How many times did you engage in testing where your arm and forearm touched the rear right of the exemplar Lexus?
Three times.
In any of those three times, did it ever leave any paint on the underside of your arm or forearm?
No.
If you could turn to slide 130, please. What? There we go. Could you go back one, please? Perhaps it's 131, Dr. Welcher. There we go. Could you explain the significance of this slide, please?
Your Honor, this is...
Oh, could you take that down, Dr. Welcher?
Yeah, sure. Mr. Brennan.
We're going to move forward. Yesterday, when we left off, I had asked you...
So we need to take this slide down.
Yeah,
sorry.
You can take the PowerPoint down, please.
I was in a different spot on this slide. Hold on a second.
That's better. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir, I had asked you yesterday about some of your opinions.
Correct.
I want to ask you about some of your opinions relative to that last effort that you made regarding testing between the Lexus and your arm.
Correct.
You had mentioned earlier on in your testimony that you reviewed a number of pieces of information and offered that you relied on some of those pieces for your opinion. Can you share with us, for this part of your analysis, what pieces of evidence or information did you rely on for the opinions I'm going to ask you?
Relative to the testing on the arm contact on the taillight?
Yes.
So it was the physical evidence at the scene, the photographs of Ms. Reed's vehicle, to a certain extent, my analysis of the Ring doorbell and the One Meadows event, the nature and location.
Just before Your Honor, pardon my interruption. I just want to know if he's reading from something or not reading.
Looks like he's counting on his finger. Are you reading from something?
No, I am counting on my finger.
Okay, thank you.
So, I am counting on my fingers. The Ring video doorbell, Mr. O'Keefe's height, you know, the type of shoes he's wearing, because I needed the same type of shoes, my exemplar inspection, where I matched up the heights, the locations of the lacerations, and then the text stream data as well.
That information that you consider, in addition to the text stream data you consider, considering both those areas of information, do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty in whether the damage to the defendant's Lexus is consistent with a collision with Mr. John O'Keefe on January 29th, 2022 at around 12:32 a.m.?
So there's been two potential theories that I've seen on that issue. One is a glass was thrown at the rear of the vehicle and shattered it. The second one was an impact to the arm. If the impact is basically more than approximately 8 miles an hour, it will likely break the taillight lens.
And do you have an opinion whether, based on the data and based on the physical damage and your testing, whether that is consistent with a collision or a impact with Mr. John O'Keefe?
It is consistent with the collision as long as it's greater than approximately 8 miles an hour.
Do you have an opinion whether it's consistent with an impact or collision with Mr. John O'Keefe on January 29, 2022 at around 12:32 a.m.?
With that caveat, yes.
In your testing, did you consider, or do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty, whether John O'Keefe's injuries on his arm, and inevitably in the back of his head, are consistent with being struck by a Lexus identical to the defendant's Lexus on January 29, 2022?
Yes.
What's your opinion?
That it is. It is consistent with being struck by a Lexus and ultimately contacting a hard surface such as frozen ground.
And does that specifically pertain to January 29, 2022, around 12:30 a.m.?
Objection, Your Honor.
I'm going to allow that.
Yes, it does.
To finish, I'd like to ask you a few more questions. You've written some papers on sideswipe collisions or clipping. Can you describe for the jury and explain what a sideswipe collision is or a clipping and how that may or may not differ from a direct hit on a pedestrian impact?
Sure. So what generally differentiates, say, sideswipes or clipping contacts compared to, say, an inline impact or, say, a T-bone impact is what refers to that the object that you're hitting isn't accelerated up to the speed of the object that's coming in. So for example, if I rear end a car, that car will be accelerated up as a result of the contact, and they reach what's called common velocity, and then they separate. And so in a glancing hit, you can have a glancing hit and you don't have what's called complete momentum transfer, meaning the momentum from the car, because it's a glancing hit, doesn't completely transfer to the object being struck. For example, you can drive down the road at 100 miles an hour and clip the mirror of a parked car and you'll break the mirror off, but you're not going to go from 100 to zero instantaneously. You're just going to keep going because you don't have all that momentum transfer. So when you have glancing contacts, you can have much higher speeds without a lot of damage to the car because you're only in momentary contact and it's a glancing type hit.
You mentioned about potential damage to a car. How about potential damage to the pedestrian?
It's the same thing. So when you have a glancing hit to a pedestrian, this is referred to as a fender vault. In this case, they call it a fender. Fenders on the front of cars, because most pedestrian impacts involve the front of cars. In this case, it would be called a quarter panel vault, which means you're kind of vaulting off the corner of the car. Those are much more complicated because you don't have that common velocity that I referred to. So it's difficult to calculate the exact speeds at which the vehicle contacted without a whole bunch of information in that type of crash. If the impact had occurred in the center of the vehicle and we knew where the point of impact was and the point of rest, we'd have a much better chance of determining how fast the vehicle was going. But when you have just a corner clipping or glancing, it makes it more difficult to determine, even when you have an area of impact, which is where the person was when they got hit, and a point of rest where they've landed, makes it more difficult for glancing contacts because you have that sideswipe problem where they don't obtain what's called common velocity.
And what are some of the other difficulties in attaining specificity in a sideswipe or being hit by a quarter panel as opposed to a fender?
So for a pedestrian, correct?
Yes.
So pedestrian impacts and how you move post-impact are very sensitive to your exact body position. For example, whether your right foot is on the ground or off the ground, whether your left foot is on the ground, off the ground, whether you jump up in response to the crash. Simply raising and lowering your arm changes the amount of rotation that's going to happen. Post-impact motion of the person. So cadavers, crash dummies don't have any muscle reaction. So the motion of a crash dummy is just gonna be like you're hitting a dead body, to where people will step, try and regain their balance if possible, will do additional activities that alters where they come to rest.
In your studies of direct pedestrian collisions by front or back bumper, as opposed to sideswipe or clipping somebody, is there a similarity or difference in type of injuries that you see?
Yes.
And what is the difference?
So in direct centralized impacts, you tend to get much more severe injuries. Really what's occurring is you're getting that momentum transfer. So it's more, you're accelerating the person up to the vehicle. They can wrap onto the side in front of the vehicle. At higher severities, their head will hit the hood, their head will hit the rear of the vehicle. So when you have that direct contact, there's actually more momentum transferred to the actual occupant. There's more applied force to the occupant as well.
When you see direct impacts, is there ever the existence of lower body extremity injuries, broken bones in the legs?
So there can be both. Depending, and again, it's very sensitive to where the foot is on the ground, whether the foot's on the ground, as well as the severity of the crash. In the presentation that I gave at the Action Reconstruction Collision Safety Institute on pedestrian injuries, I went through all the literature on lower extremity injuries and looked at what parameters affected that. And so depending on how it was loaded, some at 15 miles an hour had no injuries. Some at 15 miles an hour had some fractures. It depended on how exactly the foot was loaded.
Is it uncommon in sideswipe pedestrian accidents to see no lower body broken bone?
No, it is not uncommon.
Have you had cases that you've studied or been involved with where you've studied the effect of a sideswipe or a clipping impact where there's an absence of broken bones in the lower body extremities?
Yes.
I'd ask you to turn to slide 139, please.
Oh, sorry. I fixed those other two slides.
Okay. Could you share with the jury what this represents?
Sure. So this was a trial that I was involved with in downtown Los Angeles. I've redacted the name at the top, but this was an instance where we had, this is a image from the police report. Let me see if I can. So AOI in this diagram stands for area of impact. That's where the pedestrian was when they got hit. AOR is area of rest. And you can see we have information on exactly how far the pedestrian was thrown. Then on the right-hand side, we have photographs showing the impact to the pedestrian. This was determined by experts on both sides of this case to be between a 25 to 35 mile an hour impact. And then what you see is a close-up on the bottom slide of where there was DNA transfers, hair and tissue samples on the vehicle from the individual that was hit by the vehicle.
Next slide, please. And what does this represent?
So this is the decedent in the case, the person that was hit. He was killed at the scene. What you see on the left-hand image, on the left-hand image, is he had a massive laceration to his right forearm, but it didn't break his arm. There was no broken bones in his arm. On the right-hand side of this image, you see the autopsy report. What you'll notice is he had red marks on his leg, left buttocks, but he had no leg fractures. And again, this individual was hit at between 25 to 35 miles an hour.
Can you expand that? I'm sorry.
Yes, yes, sure.
Do you want that expanded like other times?
There you go.
Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, no, my pleasure, John. Thank you. So to at the top, he had a severe brain injury, which again is the most common injury in pedestrian crashes. He did have fractures of the right 11th and 12th rib and a liver laceration. If you look at the extremities, it says right upper extremity. Again, that's from the shoulder to the end of the hand. Extremity wound with vascular injury. So no fractures. If you look where I was talking about the multiple abrasions, so when they're looking at the lower extremities, they're noting a number of red marks, but there was notably no fractures to the lower extremities.
Thank you. You can take that down, please.
Okay.
Dr. Welch, regarding your analysis of the data and the evidence in this case, do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty whether the absence of lower body breaks to Mr. O'Keefe is consistent with the defendant's Lexus impacting in a sideswipe or a clipping Mr. O'Keefe?
Yes, you could definitely have this type of impact and not have anything beyond, say, red marks to the lower extremity.
Thank you, Dr. Welcher.
My pleasure.
I would move the evidence subject to redactions. Dr. Welcher's PowerPoint presentation.
That's by agreement, Mr. Wilson.
That is, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Put in both the flash drive and the notebook.
You mean the flash drive? Representation, it's consistent with the same as that I know.
So let's put them both together now and decide later. Okay.
Thank you.
Those two slides are incorrect on the flash drive.
Yeah,
okay, so we'll switch that. Thank you. What exhibit number is it? Oh. 206, thank you.
So it's 206 A and B.
All right, Mr. Lessie, whenever you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could have a moment to set up.
Sure.
Thank you.
Morning, Dr. Welcher.
Good morning. We haven't been formally introduced. Your whole name?
Robert Alessi, sir.
Robert Alessi. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Dr. Welcher, the area in which you engage can also include, and I believe you used the term on direct, forensics, correct? Do you engage in any forensic activity in your profession?
Yes, the general umbrella of you basically coming in giving scientific evidence in court applies to forensics. So my main job is accident reconstruction and biomechanics, and so that's what I do. Sometimes it doesn't involve court. When it goes to court, that's generally forensics.
Right, so you're here today, that is my question. You're here today, at least in part, with regard to forensics, correct? Because forensics is the Latin term for it, is basically you're gonna have some type of court or jury presentation. It's for law, correct? Would you agree with that? It's for law, forensics?
I mean, exactly the way you asked that, no. It's for engineering and it's for biomechanics. It's in the court of law, I think is what you're asking.
That's exactly it.
Okay, yes, certainly for the court of law, yes.
It ends up to a court of law, and in forensics is a common term.
Yes, sir.
So
yes.
It relates to or it's used in or it's suitable for a court of law, the analysis. You'd agree with that? It's a general principle?
Yes.
Not a trick question. Okay. And so in forensics, what you're doing, among other things, is you're applying the scientific method and principles in here in a criminal matter, correct?
Yeah, you're trying to apply as much as possible.
Right. And so the primary goal of forensic science is to uncover the truth and to provide objective evidence that can be presented in court.
That is generally correct. Again, there are elements, for example, this analysis that are relying sort of on subjective evidence, like the testimonial, the witness statements. So it's not solely based, but ideally you'd want it as much as possible based on objective data.
So you would agree that truth and objective evidence is part of the presentation in terms of information for forensics in a court of law?
Certainly objective information. Truth sometimes, again, can be subjective.
Oh, so you don't believe truth? You believe sometimes truth applies
and sometimes it
doesn't?
If you know for a fact it is true, but if you take someone's deposition testimony, you have to look at it relative to the evidence, and it's either consistent with the evidence or not.
Okay, so now let's go to your direct examination that you just went through.
Please.
Hopefully this is fairly straightforward. You have testified to, and it's varied a bit, a reasonable degree of engineering certainty, is that correct?
Correct.
Have you used the word sometimes to reasonable degree of scientific certainty?
I might have.
Right, so.
I don't know.
In terms of your role as a biomechanical engineer and accident reconstructionist, is it important to engage in a critical analysis of the data?
Critical analysis? Yeah, I think it's important to have a critical analysis. You want to try and look at it from all sides, consider all possibilities.
So it is therefore important to try to review the data as objectively as possible. You had mentioned sometimes subjectivity comes in, but I understand the goal is to try to look at it as objectively as possible, correct?
Correct.
Now, you stated with respect to your conclusions early on in your direct testimony and your analysis that you don't, and I think I've got it quoted, you don't have a dog in the fight. Is that what you said, sir?
I did.
And that you, quote, don't care, end quote, about the outcome. That's what you made a point of saying in the beginning,
that
correct?
Is 100% correct.
Now you simply follow the data. Is that correct?
I try to do that.
You try to do that.
I'm not perfect. So okay. I do my best. I believe I've done it here.
Okay. So in terms of you've agreed that you apply the scientific method, so I want to see if you're in agreement generally so the jury can understand what the scientific method is. Are you familiar with NIST, National Institute?
Yes.
Yeah. So would you agree with this definition of the scientific method? The systematic pursuit of knowledge involving the recognition and definition of a problem, the collection of data through observation and experimentation, analysis of the data, the formulation, evaluation, and testing of hypotheses, and where possible, the selection of a final hypothesis. Is that a general fair statement of the scientific method?
So for forensics, you'd have to add in the testimonial evidence aspect of it. So those are testimonial, or things are in evidence. So frequently there's one or two versions, and you're trying to match which version is most consistent with the evidence.
Okay, adding that to what I stated relative to NIST, you would agree that evaluation and testing of hypotheses, and where possible, the selection of a final hypothesis is the scientific method, correct?
Generally, yes.
Is it correct that a proper biomechanical injury analysis utilizes a sound scientific methodology that's been subjected to peer reviewed and a publication that's been generally accepted in the engineering community?
Well, I can't. So this, I've done my analysis here, biomechanical analysis. I can't submit this analysis to peer review. I'm not allowed to give this to people outside the court. So there would be no way for me to submit my analysis for peer review. So this occurs forensics all the time. The forensic analysis in court generally never goes under a peer review process. The methodologies underneath it, and looking at, like for example, I think I referenced 25 papers in my report. That goes to the issue of trying to follow the science, 26.
So I think you may have misunderstood my question, mm-hmm. sir. I was talking about your methodology, mm-hmm. your biomechanical injury methodology. The methodology that you use and apply is to be subject to peer review and general acceptance in the engineering community. Is that correct?
So I have no way of publishing this analysis.
I'm sorry, sure, to interrupt you.
I need to.
Go ahead and answer your question.
You're asked, peer review, like you said, means I give it to my peers. I send it out to somebody to review for the scientific method. That's what the peer review process is. So I will gladly send this out to peer review with the court's permission, but I haven't and cannot do that.
Sir, my question mm-hmm. is not your analysis here in this case.
Oh.
My question regards the methodology that you used here. Is the methodology, you said 26 references, right? My question is simply, is the methodology that you used for your analysis in this matter, is the methodology for a proper biomechanical analysis, should that methodology be generally accepted in the engineering community?
I think with the forensic application, yes.
Okay, that was my question, just the methodology. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, the scientific method that you've used in this case, part of the use of scientific method, the purpose is to avoid what is called bias in the scientific method, right? Not cultural bias, but just bias in terms of the application of methodologies and principles. You would agree that's a pretty fundamental purpose of the scientific method, is to avoid biases?
The purpose of the scientific method is to get the most logical and correct answer without bias.
Exactly. To do it with, apply the scientific method without bias being part of its, the application of the method, correct?
That's hopefully what you can do.
That's hopefully what you can do. That is the goal, right?
That is one of many goals, yes.
So Are you familiar with the term confirmation bias?
I am.
And that relates, confirmation bias is part of a larger term. Are you familiar with cognitive bias?
Generally, I'm not a human factors expert, though.
Pardon me?
I'm not a human factors expert.
All right, this is, biases are, don't you agree that cognitive biases are not just for one category? You would agree it applies to medical analyses, it applies to doctors doing studies, engineers doing studies, and other scientists doing studies?
So I'm not a cognitive expert. I think I would generally agree with it, but I don't want to step out of my lane. I'm not an expert on cognitive. I can talk to you about confirmational bias, if
Fair.
You like.
Let's talk about confirmation bias. Now, confirmation bias is actually when someone selectively gathers and interprets evidence to confirm one or another's beliefs, as well as neglecting evidence that contradicts those beliefs. Is that a fair statement of confirmation bias?
That is a statement. Yeah, it could be broader, but sure.
But you would agree that that is generally correct, what
generally,
confirmation
yes.
bias is. And an example of confirmation bias is not considering alternative hypotheses once an initial hypothesis has been selected, even though data and information might contradict the initial hypothesis. Is that an example of confirmation bias?
That could be, yes.
And confirmation bias is antithetical. It's against the scientific method. It's to be avoided, correct?
You would like to avoid it, yes.
Are you familiar with the term failure analysis?
Generally, you might need to define how you're using it for me.
Sure. So is failure analysis the enablement of a scientific examination of an alleged incident by beginning at the undesired consequences? Is that a fair use of that phrase?
I was thinking something different, like a piece of metal failing. I guess it could fall into that category.
Okay. And would you agree that the first question, or one of the first questions that are to be asked by a biomechanical engineer when conducting an analysis of, say, an injury, is how did this happen? Is that one of the first few questions that you ask?
No, that's usually the last question.
Oh, so for you...
So hold on a second.
Okay,
generally, what you want to do is gather data. You want to know what injuries there are, what evidence there is, like, for example, on the vehicles. And then the very last thing you want to know or define is, given all that information, how did it happen? So that's the end.
I think you may have misunderstood my question, sir. I wasn't talking about the method or the process. I was talking about when you get to answering questions, whenever that is in the process. Isn't one of the questions, and maybe one of the first questions, how did this happen?
No. That's not one of the first questions. One of the first questions is, where's the damage? What are the injuries? What's the evidence? What black box or tech stream data do we have? What physical evidence was at the scene? So that is certainly not one. It is a question, but that question is at or near the end.
Isn't every one of the questions that you just mentioned part of the data gathering?
Correct, but
okay.
But when you're gathering data, you're always asking yourself questions along the way, like, what is this? Where did it come from?
But you would agree that for you, at least some point, it's how did this happen, correct?
Yes.
And don't you ask that question to come up with hypotheses?
I generally have many working hypotheses as I'm working on the case. And then as the evidence comes in, I'm applying that to my hypotheses and either accepting or rejecting the hypotheses based upon the factual information.
Sir, how then, is it just a matter of logic or a syllogism? If you don't ask the question, how did this happen until the end, how do you then not get your hypotheses up front when under the scientific method, you should be having
different hypotheses up front. How is it that you ask the how did it happen in the end and not go through hypotheses in the beginning? Can you help me with that logic?
Sure. I guess I misunderstood. Like, I was trying to give you an answer to how it happened. So when you're answering how it happened, or you want to be able to answer that question, you want to make sure you've looked at the totality of the data, accepted, rejected things as they came along, to be able to answer that final question, how did it happen? But along the way, like for example, a right eye laceration, you want to know how that happened. So you look for the evidence of how that may have happened.
So you would agree then that questions of how it happened, formulating and identifying hypotheses, does and can happen toward the beginning of the analysis. It doesn't happen at the end all the time. Would you agree with that?
So the ultimate question of how did it happen happens at the end. The questions about the elements of what occurred to make it happen, those occur at the beginning, middle, all along the way.
You would agree that creating hypotheses occurs more toward the beginning than toward the end of the analysis. Is that correct?
There are probably more hypotheses in the beginning, but I am continually forming, looking at hypotheses, either accepting or rejecting them upon the evidence.
So you would agree that the creation of hypotheses does occur more toward the beginning of the analysis. You would agree with that?
There are more towards the beginning. The process occurs throughout the whole investigation.
Right. I'm asking about the hypotheses, sir. You would agree that the hypotheses occur more toward the beginning than the end, just the hypotheses.
So I don't know if you and I are saying different things. More hypotheses in the beginning, because you have more questions in the beginning. You continue to form hypotheses as the data presents itself. So you don't stop the formation of hypotheses. It's just as you get more evidence, you window down the number of questions.
Maybe I can just this last question and make it clearer for you, sir. You would agree, not analysis, which you added, as I heard it to the last part, just hypotheses.
Mm-hmm.
You would agree that even though hypotheses can be created and changed, perhaps all the way up to the end,
mm-hmm.
you would agree that it's important in the analysis to create at least some hypotheses, plural, in the beginning, correct?
Yes.
And once you create these hypotheses, would you agree that those hypotheses should be tested?
So if you take the word testing to mean testing compared to testimony, compared to physical evidence, yes.
And when you test those hypotheses, isn't it often the case that, particularly in your line of work, the one that most consistently produces the same injury will emerge as the mechanism of injury?
I guess it depends on the scientific evidence behind it. Again, sometimes we get very unique injuries.
So my question, sir, is this.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it the case that when you have multiple hypotheses, the one that most, out of all of them, it's a relative thing, the one that most consistently produces the same injury emerges as the mechanism of injury? Is that a fair statement?
I think generally, again, it's on a case-by-case basis. You have to look at the science and the facts of what you're basing it upon. I think as a general premise, what you're saying is accurate.
Okay.
But there's exceptions.
Fair enough. But it's a general principle,
sure,
with some exceptions. That's a fair statement, correct?
Yes, sir.
We're going to have several topics, sir, and what I'm going to try to do to make it a little clearer is I'm going to say when I'm switching topics.
Oh, good.
So what I'd like to do now is switch topics.
Okay.
You're aware that the Massachusetts State Police has troopers who specialize in accident reconstruction, correct?
Yes.
And there are troopers within the Massachusetts State Police Collision Analysis and Reconstruction Section whose sole responsibility is to engage in accident reconstruction. Do you know that?
I do not know that.
Do you know that there are troopers within the Massachusetts State Police Collision Analysis and Reconstruction Section who engage in accident reconstruction?
Just based on what I've seen in this case.
Right. Based upon what you've seen in the case, that's a fair statement.
And I just know that those people are doing it.
Are you familiar with a Massachusetts state trooper named Joseph Paul, P-A-U-L?
Yes.
And you
well,
know...
Well, I'm familiar with his reports. I don't know the man.
Okay. Familiar with Trooper Paul through his reports in this case, correct?
Correct.
And are you aware that he was assigned by lead investigator, former Trooper Michael Proctor, to be a... Constructionist in this case on January 29th of 2022 as evidenced by that report or those reports of Trooper Paul. Do you know that?
Well, you put a lot of things in there. I know he issued a reconstruction report. I don't know who told him to do it. So the first party question, I don't know, but I did see a reconstruction report from him.
You were retained, and so do you recall, is it the date January 29th of 2022? 22, is that a rough time period of him being assigned, or you don't know when he was assigned?
I don't know. That might have been in his report, but I wouldn't have paid attention to when he received an assignment.
Do you know when the date of the first report of Trooper Joseph Paul in this case?
I can pull it up. I do not know off the top of my head.
You know that the date of the incident in question is January 29th, 2022, correct?
Correct.
Yet your firm and you were retained for this case by the Commonwealth 2.5 years after the incident in question. You were retained, your firm, on September 23rd, 2024. Is that correct, sir?
No, I believe we were retained a couple days before that.
A couple days. Okay.
Right.
So...
Actually, I might be able to find out if you'd like me to look at the documents.
It's not all that important. You would say it's within a week of September 23rd, 2000. It was in September of 2024?
I believe it was in September, yes.
Right.
I would want to double check.
That's 2.5 years from the date of the incident in question, if I did the math right, correct?
I never thought about it. Yeah, approximately.
And as we just discussed, you stated on your direct examination, you have no dog in this fight, correct?
Correct.
On November 5th of 2024, your firm Aperture was paid $44,500 by the Norfolk County District Attorney's Office to conduct work that was at least similar to the work of Trooper Paul, correct?
I have no idea. I don't get the billing or the statements.
Do you recall whether Aperture has, well, do you believe Aperture is working for free in this matter?
Oh, no, I don't believe that. No,
so
we're an engineering company. We bill for our time. So
you know that Aperture is getting paid for its work in this case, correct?
We are billing for our analysis work.
Well, you're not just billing, you're billing and getting paid, correct?
So I have not seen any of the payments. I would assume that we're getting paid, but I don't know that.
Sir, you are a senior vice president of Aperture, are you not?
I am.
You would know, wouldn't you, if your firm was not getting paid
for work since September 23rd of 2024, wouldn't you?
No, probably not. Usually it takes, you know, 9, 10, 12 months of not getting paid before the accounting department reaches out to me.
Exactly. So you've been on this for 2.5 years. So if it would take 9 months or 12 months, if you weren't getting paid, you would have been notified by that by now, correct? According to your own answer you just gave.
I've not been on this case for 2.5 years.
I'm sorry, sir. Let me go back to the question of payment.
Hold on. You said I've been on this case for 2.5 years. I was retained in September 17th-ish of 2024. So that's, what, less than a year ago?
Understood. I'm moving on to the next question because I want to move away from that discussion and just go right to the billing. You, as you sit here today, do not have a recollection of whether Aperture has been paid. Is that your testimony?
It has nothing to do with recollection. I'm not part of that process. We have an accounting department. I don't have any involvement in that.
Are you, so is your testimony you have no knowledge about any contractual relationship between Aperture and the Commonwealth?
Oh, no, no. I was sent a contract by the Commonwealth to sign, so I'm aware of the contractual agreement. But the day-to-day or month-to-month invoicing and billing, I'm not involved in that.
Okay. So you're aware there's a contract between Aperture and the Commonwealth?
I signed it.
And you signed it. And wasn't that contract obligating the Commonwealth to pay for the services of Aperture? Isn't that the purpose of the contract, in part?
In part, sure.
Yeah. It's a legal obligation of the Commonwealth. Your firm does work, and the Commonwealth pays for it, correct?
That's the idea.
Right, and so you know about that contract because you signed it?
Correct.
Also, you testified on direct that there was a purchase of a Lexus exemplar for your testing?
Correct.
Who pays for that Lexus exemplar?
Aperture.
And is that then cost passed on to the Commonwealth?
No.
So you pay for the Lexus, you don't pass that cost on, correct?
So what we're doing is we paid for the Lexus, we're keeping it till the trial's over, we're selling it and charging the Commonwealth the difference in the price.
Exactly. That was where I was going, sir. So,
but they're only paying the difference. So, and in theory, if we sell it for more in California, then we'll reduce the bill.
Okay, I don't want to speculate. I just wanted to see what the obligation was.
So the obligation is the difference.
Exactly. So the obligation is the difference. Are you aware that on April 5th, 2025, the Norfolk County District Attorney's Office amended your contract? Are you aware of that, sir?
I am.
And isn't it the case that that amendment authorized the amount of $325,000 to be paid to Aperture? Isn't that what that amendment contract states?
I believe that's correct.
So the Commonwealth is obligated to pay at least $325,000, and is that correct?
That is my, you're asking me a legal opinion now about a contract. That is my understanding of how contracts work, but I'm certainly not an attorney.
And on top of that, are you aware that Aperture has been already paid $44,510 for its work? Are you aware of that?
The second time you asked me, no. I'm not aware of anything we've been paid.
And as you stated yourself, those amounts reflect, as you say, less than 6 months' worth of work?
That's not what I said.
Well, no, my question is, you've been on the case, you said, since September of 2024, when we were talking about dates, you said that was about 6 months that your firm's been retained. Did I have your answer correct about how long you've been on it?
I guess it's closer to 8 months.
All right, so 8 months. So for 8 months of work, about $400,000. Is that correct?
So there's three offices working on the case. There's the Boston office, there's Mr. Burgess's office, and there's my office in Long Beach. I only know about the billing from my office.
But you signed the contract on behalf of all of Aperture, not just your office, correct?
That I don't know. But I definitely did sign a contract.
Would it refresh your recollection as to who you signed the contract on behalf of, whether it's all of Aperture and all offices, if I showed you the contract?
Sure.
May I put you on?
Yes.
Sir,
yeah, could you direct me so we're not wasting time?
What I'd like to do, with the witness, Your Honor, is just ask the witness a question with regard to it.
Why don't you just take a look at that, Dr. Burgess?
Thank you, Your Honor.
And then, when he's done, Mr. Lessie, you can take it and go back to the podium.
Yes, Your Honor.
There you go.
I have a few more questions before I do that, Your Honor, for foundation purposes, if I want to do more than a refresher.
All right.
Would you like me to start with a refresher?
Go ahead and start with three friends. Go back to the podium, please.
Sure, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Dr. Welcher, does that refresh your recollection as to the contract you signed on behalf of Aperture with the Commonwealth?
So it lists the legal address as my office. So for my office, yes.
So are you saying that therefore, and did you see the amount that was in the contract? Did that refresh your recollection?
Oh, no, I didn't even look at that.
Do you recall the amount that of obligation that the contract relates to in this document? Do you recall that?
You just asked me that earlier, and I'm taking what you said to be true. So it was like $325,000. I have no reason to disbelieve that.
And is there also a total, do you recall the total maximum obligation for the contract that's listed in the contract? You
no.
Recall it. May I approach, Your Honor?
Okay.
And Dr. Welcher, I am now going to, you asked me last time, I hope this is helpful.
Please.
You said please point to the applicable part so we can do it faster. I am now pointing to that part and see if you can just look at that and see whether this refreshes your recollection on the maximum obligation of the contract pursuant to this contract. Without saying what it is, just does it refresh your recollection?
No, but I don't have any reason to believe it's not correct. And that is my signature on it.
Right.
And we got started on this conversation tying it to, well, we got started on this conversation with regard to a statement you made earlier in your direct that you didn't have any dog in the hunt. You recall that statement in the beginning of your direct testimony?
You misquoted me. I don't have any dog in the fight.
You don't have any dog in the fight?
Correct.
Thank you. Now, switching topics.
Okay.
You submitted an updated PowerPoint presentation, the one that you went over on your direct examination. You created that presentation quite recently, correct, sir?
The updated one was where I had redacted or taken out slides. So in terms of taking out slides, I did add one alternative path a couple weeks ago.
Okay, my question, sir, is this.
Mm-hmm.
The updated presentation, we'll get to the changes later, but the updated presentation, you created just how many days ago?
I'm going to say weeks ago.
Weeks? 2 weeks?
I don't actually know without looking at the documents.
Well, was it more than 3 weeks ago that you created it?
I still don't know without looking at the documents.
Do you know when the trial started in this matter, sir?
I do not.
Assume the trial started approximately April 22nd of 2024.
Okay.
Did you create your updated presentation before or after April 22nd of 2024?
I don't know.
Do you know when...
Hold on one second. Dr. Welch, I'd ask that you not do
not look at. Okay, I was going to try and answer his question. My apologies. I will shut it down.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
If I may, Your Honor, please continue.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's the Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.